American, European, and Ukrainian leaders are meeting in Geneva, Switzerland as we speak, and they have been since yesterday, to see if they can finally come to an agreement on what it's going to take to get the Russia-Ukraine war over. Lots of positive statements have been coming out, a lot of optimism in some quarters, lots of anger and fear in other quarters, but the question is, are we getting close? Depending on who you want to listen to, maybe yes, maybe no, and then other people are seeming to completely torpedo anything coming out. And I'm talking about from within the Western camp. This is a mess, and it really just kind of encapsulates why this war is continuing to struggle on, because the West has no bloody idea what it even wants to accomplish or what it can accomplish. First of all, here's President Trump just hours ago saying, is it really possible that big progress is being made in the peace talks between Russia and Ukraine? Don't believe it until you see it, but something good may just be happening. God bless America. I mean, even in the context of that one very short Truth Social by Trump terms, it's like, wait a minute, there's maybe some deals. Well, maybe there's not. Don't believe it until you see it. I'm kind of believing that part here, but maybe something great. I mean, it doesn't, I guess, exactly fill you with confidence that the negotiators for President Trump are really going to get something done here. But whatever you may think about what that is, if you're going to listen to the president of Ukraine, the guy upon who has to make the decision to agree to anything that Trump may want, yeah, not quite as good as you might hope.
It is crucial to support the principles on which Europe stands, that borders cannot be changed by force, that war criminals must not escape justice, and that the aggressor must pay fully for the war he started. And this is why decisions on Russian assets are essential.
So, I mean, just right off the top, this war, if Zelensky had been the one on the military superiority, if he is the one that had the dominant balance of power between the two sides, that comment would be reasonable. You would think, well, I mean, that's what people do when they're on the top. That's not what people do when they're on the bottom of a balance of power dynamic. You can't talk that big kind of smack when you have nothing to back it up with. So listen, let's put this in context. Here you have the president of the United States last week, remember, made this big statement, and apparently behind the scenes, Zelensky had like a week to make a decision. You remember that? By November 27th. This coming Thursday, there was this unofficial ultimatum that was given to Ukraine. Then Zelensky comes out. You may remember that one, too. We showed you where he's standing on this cloudy gray day in front of one of his government buildings with very somber and talking about how I've been given a choice, either dignity and freedom or basically capitulation, and I've got to decide what I'm going to do. So he knew, and he was clearly told, you don't have much time. Trump has been saying, yes, we're going to reach an end. We're going to get this done. And then now here today, Zelensky is basically given his own ultimatum. And it didn't stop there. He went a little bit further.
Occupied territories remain occupied. And that means Russia remains a criminal state. Today, almost 70 parliamentary delegations are present. And if parliaments in Europe, in the world, do not close their eyes to this, then no one will.
So, the criminal state. Russia is a criminal state. Again, these are not words you use if you're looking to find a negotiated settlement, especially if you're on the bottom half of that dynamic of the balance of power. And yet that's where he is. So what is President Trump to think about this? What are his negotiating team, who's in Geneva, to think about this? What is Vladimir Putin to think about this? Well, we don't have to wonder about that, because he made a statement also that's not at all surprising with what you would expect from the guy on the upper side of the balance of power.
What the political leadership of Ukraine is, we already understand. Yes, since March of last year, it is no longer any kind of political leadership. It is a group of individuals, a criminal gang, an organized criminal community that, since March of last year, has usurped power and, under the pretext of the need to continue the war with Russia, is holding on to this power in Ukraine for the purpose of personal enrichment. But we have our own tasks, our own goals. The main one is the unconditional achievement of the objectives of the special military operation and the fulfillment of the tasks that our fatherland and the people of Russia set before us. The people of Russia are counting on us, counting on you, and expecting the result the country needs.
So you have these dueling narratives. That one was on the 22nd of November. I think it was the 17th. Yeah, it was 22nd. And then you had Zelensky the next day. And you have them almost given mirror images of one another. They're both saying that the other regime is illegitimate, criminal regime, and the Ukraine, what he claimed. Somebody who's usurped power on the other side here. So they're both kind of saying that. The Ukraine side says, yes, we have to basically have everything that we want. We're not going to give away any territory. We're not going to change any borders by force, et cetera. And our freedom and democracy are not up for anybody's sale. They're not going to change. You have the Russian side saying, we will accomplish all of our objectives set in the special military operations. And that's the really the sine qua non of it. That's what we're saying. The idea set before us, that's what he said. That's what Putin has said from the beginning. Now he's saying here again, wearing a military uniform in front of his commanders. So where is diplomacy in all this? This is, listen, you just got to recognize, let's don't lose sight of just how dystopian this whole situation is. Here's the president of the United States gives apparently a 7-day deadline, an ultimatum to Ukraine. You either, according to reports, you either come to an agreement that we'll agree to, or we're going to walk and we're going to withdraw all of our weapons, all of our ammunition, everything. That's what's been reported. And obviously something like that was said because now then everyone's scrambling in the West. European, as Zelensky mentioned, there's 17 European parliaments are gathered together. All kinds of negotiators are in Geneva right now from Europe, from Ukraine, from the United States. The U.S. Secretary of State is there. Everybody's there trying to find a negotiated settlement. But then you have Zelensky, who seems to just throw not cold water, but like hot coals on anybody's opportunity to try and have a negotiated settlement by just exacerbating the situation and blasting the Russians in public in the most strong terms imaginable. Meanwhile, you have the Russian side, who's also in uniform, military uniform, in front of his military commanders, saying that the leadership of Ukraine is an illegitimate clique, as they've called them. And we're going to achieve our objectives, he says. And he commands his military forces to do that. Where's the diplomacy in that? Because all I see is one side on the bottom that's unwilling to acknowledge reality and says, I don't care about any of that. We are still looking for maximalist outcomes to what we want, how we define peace, how we define a just and lasting end to this, etc. That's what Zelensky's saying, despite all of this diplomacy going on. You have the Russian side saying, military dude, that's where we're at. That's where we're going. We're going to accomplish these objectives. Nobody of the two protagonists in this war are talking about diplomacy. Now, the Russians sometimes do, and they're saying, as Putin did, and I guess it was September in Beijing, where he says, we'll accomplish it with negotiations or we'll accomplish it with military power, but we're going to accomplish it one way or the other. And let's understand what the conditions are in the terms. Here is what Russia is saying, because this was reiterated by Sergei Lavrov less than 1 week ago. He specifically referred to what Vladimir Putin said on June 14th, 2024. He said, those are the terms we are still trying to accomplish right now. And that is when Putin just said our objectives will be met. These are the objectives he previously set.
The essence of our proposal is not some kind of temporary truce or suspension of fire, as, for example, the West wants. This is not about freezing the conflict, but about its final completion. And I will say again, as soon as Kiev agrees to a similar course of events proposed today, agrees to the complete withdrawal of its troops from the DPR and LPR in the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, and really begins this process, we are ready to begin negotiations without delaying them. I repeat, this is our principled position. Neutral, non-aligned, nuclear-free status of Ukraine, its demilitarization and denazification.
So there you have it. Territorial of all of the four oblasts that Russia annexed, which means considerable portions especially three of those four that Ukraine still possesses. That's what he said. You withdraw from all of those to the administrative borders that we have. And then that's where we start the negotiations. Then we go with demilitarization. And by what the one of the, I think it was the speaker of the Russian Duma said around this same time, was it was around 85,000 troops. That's what they said in the entire army. That's what demilitarization would mean there. Denazification and no NATO. There's the neutrality of Ukraine. Basically, in its essence, Russia says our objectives are to have a non-threatening entity on our border, on our western border. When we're satisfied that there's no political or military threat to our border, that's it. We're good to go. We call the war over. And we're going to get it if you can agree to it as these negotiated terms. And as I said at the time, and I've said every day since, those are draconian for the Ukraine side. They're awful. But they're also the only ones on the table. And you see from Zelensky just a minute ago, he's still unwilling to contemplate any of them. He's still asking for his own territorial integrity. He's still asking for no one's going to tell us. And Europeans have been echoing this in the last 36 hours, too. Nobody's going to say who we can join in any military organization. Nobody's going to say how big their military can be. No one's going to limit the capabilities that they have. And no one's going to tell Europe what they can do. So they are absolutely feeding Ukraine and Zelensky in particular with all of the encouragement necessary to repudiate whatever it is that Trump has been offering behind the scenes and whatever it is, and we know actually what Russia is willing to contemplate in front of the scenes. Now, those entities, Europe, Ukraine, and Russia, they're kind of on display here. Now, in light of all this, and in light of Trump's comments there at the minute ago that I showed you from this morning on Truth Social, yesterday, Secretary of State Rubio actually seemed optimistic.
We arrived here today with one goal, and the goal was to take, is 28 points or 26 points, depending on which version as it continued to evolve, and try to narrow the ones that were open items. And we have achieved that today in a very substantial way. Now, obviously, like any final agreement, they'll have to be agreed upon by the presidents, and there are a couple issues that we need to continue to work on. But I think the report today is that I think today was worthwhile. It was very, very – it is probably the most productive day we have had on this issue, maybe in the entirety of our engagement, but certainly in a very long time. But work remains, and because this continues to be a working process, I don't want to declare victory or finality here. There's still some work to be done. But we are much further ahead today at this time than we were when we began this morning.
Okay, now recall – all the things he's talking about are on this so-called 28-point peace plan that the United States has issued here. And believe me, that 28-point peace plan looks nothing like what Zelensky and the European leaders are saying today. And so here just yesterday, you had the Secretary of State of the United States of America, presumably in close coordination with President Trump, who authorized, if not authored, this 28-point peace plan. Probably didn't author it, but at least he was part of the process and said yes or no. I mean, he has had the final decision-making on that. And now then you see that it seems to have been almost totally repudiated by Zelensky with that very, very boisterous, in-your-face condemnation, outright condemnation of the Russian side. And of course, he mentions 17 European parliaments are on his back and giving him encouragement. And if you've seen any of the comments earlier today from Ursula von der Leyen, some of the other European leaders, you can see that they are totally in support of what he says. And none of them say anything remotely close to the American position, to what Secretary of State Rubio said. So I guess on the one hand, you can look at President Trump's Truth Social and say, well, that kind of makes sense because you say, I'll believe it when I see it. Okay. But if you're the deal maker, if you're the guy who brags to everybody about all these wars that you've ended and how great your negotiating skills are, and you're almost like just an innocent bystander, just like somebody watching a tennis match. Well, I'll believe it when I see it. Well, your name is on this. Your credibility is on the table here. The credibility of the United States, because you're in the office, so you carry it with you. And then you have your Secretary of State on one day talking about how we're really close, the most productive day we've had. And then the next day, in a repudiation, not just of Russia, but of America. Because that's the way you have to read what Zelensky said there, because it's nothing close to this 28-point peace plan. It's a much closer to what the Europeans have continued to say, that it's going to be our way or no way. It's our way or the highway. Well, as I just told you, Russia is going to say, okay, if that's the way you want it, then it'll be the highway. And we have a lot of tanks and personnel carriers and troops and drones to fly over that highway. I'm not sure that's a path you want to go down, but the Russians are going, fair enough, I suppose. We're willing to go down that path. Now, one of the reasons I think why the Europeans and Ukrainians are apparently willing to go down that path is because of incredible delusionary opinion that the Russians are, in fact, a paper tiger. You may recall some number of weeks ago, President Trump quipped that maybe Russia's just a paper tiger. Okay. I guess if you think that that Russia is a paper tiger, then you can say, yeah, we'll just do whatever you want. Well, here's some of the reason why the Western Europeans think that they are a paper tiger. Here's NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte mocking the Russian military.
What is your estimation on how much the Russians might need this to end?
Russians have gained 1% of Ukrainian territory so far this year, so this is a few yards a day. We all know now the name of this famous city, Pokrovsk. They started 18 months ago to grab that city, and they still have not fully succeeded in doing so. And indeed, they are losing 20,000 men a month, the same amount as the Soviet lost in 10 years in Afghanistan. And then Putin having to increase now his taxes. You only do that if there is absolutely no alternative left. So him doing this means that they are not in a good place. But in the end, we cannot wait him out.
Okay, more of this doublespeak. And that means that Putin is not in a good place, but we can't wait him out. Well, hang on. If he's not in a good place, you can wait him out. But if he is in a good place, you can't wait him out. And he mentions Pokrovsk. Let me show you this real quick. This is today. You see that every time I show this, it gets less and less yellow. You see now Mirnograd is hardly any of it is under full control of the Ukraine side. The red continues to expand, and the gray tone continues to expand all around it. There's hardly anything left here. Yes, it has taken 18 months, but how many Ukrainian military personnel have died in defense of this? You see, we keep talking to this over and over. The Russian objective is not territorial acquisition per se. That's a byproduct of what their actual objective is, which is the destruction of the Ukrainian armed forces. And you see there that now, because of all of the Ukrainians who have died in the process here, with all of the priority on firepower from the Russian side, so that the Russians minimize the loss of their troops and maximize the loss of the Ukrainian troops. Whether it took 18 months or 18 weeks, it doesn't make any difference. Ultimately, you lost it, just like you did with Severodonetsk, with Lysychansk, with Mariupol, with Bakhmut, with Avdiivka, with the incursion into Kursk, with the Krinky attack down on the Dnipro. You see what I'm saying here? Every time you want to look at any of these battlefields, you keep getting over and over that the Russian military destroys the Ukrainian military. They destroyed them on the Dnipro. They destroyed them in the Kursk operation. They destroyed them in Bakhmut. Do you see the pattern here? And they are destroying them in the Kupiansk area up in the north and in Pokrovsk there, I just showed you. Common theme over and over is the destruction of them. The West somehow, I don't know. Maybe they think Russia's a paper tiger, or maybe they're just oblivious to the realities of the combat ground, and they think that their capabilities are more. Well, as it turns out, let's see, the only way out of this conflict is for Russia to leave Ukraine. That's the way out of this conflict, this former Finland prime minister. Yeah, so you see, I mean, that's the kind of the dystopian view. That all of those things I just showed you, folks, those are all Russian battlefield victories. How many Ukrainian battlefield victories can I give you? You can go back to 2022, in Kursk, in the Kharkiv area, sorry, and in the Kherson area. And those are the only two battlefield victories you have. Since 2022, there have been this many. There have been none. And yet, you want to sit there and confidently say in your really nice little white suit there, yep, the only path is the Ukraine military victory and Russia leaving and going home. So what you're saying is you are condemning Ukraine to continue fighting a war it cannot win until there literally is no one left to fight it. I mean, this claim that you'll fight to the last Ukrainian is on full display right there and on what Mark Rutte has said there. So they want to continue going on. Well, part of the additional problem from the Western side is this gross misunderstanding of the nature of warfare today. There was an article, it was about a week or so ago, in a Ukrainian publication. It was the BBC News from Ukraine. This is translated into English. But this says NATO manuals no longer work. Why Ukrainian military was not trained to fight with drones at Polish training grounds. What this talks about here, and I think we have this... they don't have this. This was referred to in a video by our friend Alex History Legends, and he discusses some of the realities of this. This is hard to believe. I think we have the full video of his, and I strongly recommend you go into the description there. You can read it later, watch the whole thing later. But here is one evidence, and this is shocking. I'm just going to set this up. This is nearly 4 years into war. This is from Western NATO troops, Poland and Czech, I believe, that were training Ukrainian folks last month at a new Czech training ground. Watch this.
They were surprised by scenarios where an APC crosses a river. They told instructors directly that any equipment will be destroyed by drones before it even approaches the shore. Then came the Czechs. During one of those exercises, Czech paratroopers had to storm Ukrainian positions. So you have Czech troops playing Team Red. They were commanded by an instructor called Yakub, a veteran from Afghanistan, while the Ukrainian Team Blue was preparing for the defense. The exercise starts. Czech troops leave the assembly area. I believe they formed attack columns and then advanced towards Ukrainian positions. Meanwhile, the Ukrainians simply launched their Mavic drones. Then the article says that... after the first attempt, instructor Yakub stopped the scenario and asked, "Can we take out the Mavics?" Ukrainian commander 18 asked why. The Czech commander Yakub replied, "You find us too fast with your Mavics, and we can't get to you. You detect us on the approach to your positions." Wow.
That all I can say is wow, too. That is, let me just underscore this. As someone who has fought in four combat deployments to include tank-on-tank warfare, I'm just stunned beyond belief. Now, I thought that because of the 2020 Armenia-Azerbaijan war, where a lot of drones were used that just crushed the armor, I thought, man, warfare has changed forever, especially when it looked like there was going to be war between Russia and Ukraine. I thought, man, the Russians, especially with their relationship with Azerbaijan and their proximity there, would definitely have watched this, and they're probably going to be all over this. They probably were going to be ready for this drone warfare from the beginning because they have so many more assets. Turns out I was wrong. Turns out that I gave Russia too much credit. They weren't ready. Neither was the Ukraine side. In fact, neither one of them were at the beginning. Now, they changed that pretty quickly, and in fact, the Ukraine side adopted more quickly. But they proved why that should have happened before the first round was fired, and then they figured it out pretty quickly. Now, you can wag a finger a bit at both of those two sides for like going, how could y'all have missed that? I mean, it was self-evident that that's where it was going, and to have not prepared ahead of time, it's kind of embarrassing for both of you, but especially the Russian side, in my view. But what can we say about our side, folks, when nearly 4 years into this war, more than 5 years, close to six now, on the other side of the Armenia-Azerbaijan war, we're still conducting training exercises that we don't have drones even in. And now that we're trying to train these guys on the Ukraine side, and the article stipulates that only a handful of them actually had combat experience, the rest of them were new recruits that they were trying to train. But there were some combat experienced guys there, which is the reason why they were like going, well, obviously, we're going to use drones. I mean, that's a normal part of every single operation in the Russia-Ukraine war. And the so-called trainers, the guys who were supposed to be training the new people, didn't have any plan to even incorporate drones, to the point to where, hang on, this is not working out because of the adjudication. Our troops are all being killed before they even get to the line of contact at the river. So you got to take them out. Otherwise, there's not going to be any training. And the other side is going, you realize, of course, that in real life, you would never get to the line of contact. You would never get to the river line. So there wouldn't be an engagement because you'd be dead long before you got here. That's how it works on both sides of the line every single day. And we seem to be oblivious to that. We seem to not realize that. And just consider, if we're training them like that, what do you think we're doing to our own troops? What do our own training exercises look like? Now, the United States has at least publicly said that we're buying millions of drones, that we're incorporating them in. So maybe we're doing more on that. But I wager strongly, based on my experience of having been in the U.S. Army for 2 full decades, after having seen how we do with acquisition and how we are so slow to actually adopt changes, and we are so low at the leader level to do anything different than we did in the past, things that worked really well, like we want to do what we did in Desert Storm or Operation Enduring Freedom and back going to Baghdad with tanks in 2003. We want to just do it a little bit better. We want to do the same thing, things we did. And you recall earlier this summer, I mocked the U.S., because we came out with this new armored training manual at the armored platoon level, and the Ukrainian military mocked it first, which is where I even heard about it, because they said these battle drills you're using here are laughable. They would never work in this drone environment. So even though we at least the U.S. Army gave some kind of nod to the presence of drones, we didn't understand their true power and how hard it is to operate, especially in a mechanized operation. But now here are NATO allies, I apparently know even less, to the point to where they're not even using it in their training scenarios. And if they're not using it for Ukraine folks, it seems pretty unlikely that they're using it for their own troops here. These are the people upon who you want to base the security of Europe. So apparently the Europeans are dysfunctional at the political level. They're dysfunction at the diplomatic level, that's for sure. But it now also appears that they're dysfunctional at the tactical level. And obviously, I've been talking about for a long time, allegedly it was an American general that was significantly part of the planning for the disastrously failed Ukrainian offensive in 2023, the one that should have ended the war, because it exposed that the Ukraine side was never going to be able to recover from that, and that they couldn't, even with all the preparation, defeat the Russian lines. But it didn't. We still did not recognize that. We have French generals that are saying, yeah, we got to get ready for a war. We have German generals, of course, saying that we have to get ready for war, obviously, in the Baltics, Poland, all of them. But now Poland and Czech, apparently, according to that article anyway, by Ukrainians, reported by the BBC, is that we don't even know how to conduct modern warfare, even after 4 years. If I had condemnation on both the Russian and Ukraine militaries for not being ready from the Armenia-Azerbaijan war, how much more guilt should we heap upon our leaders that after that war and 4 years of this one, we're still not ready? We're still not incorporating the lessons that are on display every single day, which we give verbal assent to. We claim that we understand it. We say we observe it. And yet when you see it's not translating into the actual operations, that exercise that was described in that paper should 100% have used incorporated drones on both the offensive and the defensive forces. That should have been a literal scripted in part of it, that no one should have even thought of starting it without understanding that both of those would be present. And instead, they wanted none of them present. They apparently didn't have any on the offensive side, and they didn't want the defense side to have it. Otherwise, we couldn't do the exercise. That is wow, to quote Alex in History Lesson. So how do we think this is going to work out? Because you know who's not saying wow? Who's not being unwilling to acknowledge failures and then make changes? It's the Russian side. We see on the battlefield that they're doing whatever it takes to succeed, and that they're doing things that, based on the new technologies of war and on the adjusting doctrine that they're employing, that they're saying, we're going to minimize the risk to our troops, because there's no more of these so-called meat waves, if there ever were any, but now they're definitely not. because they're prioritizing firepower because of their defense industrial base and the decisions that they made years ago put into effect. Now then they are preserving their own troops. They're minimizing the risk while maximizing the threat to the other side with drones of multiple calibers, electronic warfare, glide bombs, long-range drones, new technology in glide bombs, etc. And of course, the artillery continues. Also, there's been advancements technologically in the artillery. So the Russians have never stopped. They've never sit still. They're continuing to expand both their capability and their technology simultaneously. They never stopped. They still haven't stopped. The Ukraine side can never catch up. And instead of recognizing these painfully bloody obvious truths on the battlefield, we just continue to say, nope. We're going to set the conditions, we meaning in this case, Europe and Ukraine, we're going to set the conditions to don't care what the Russians say. I don't even care what the Americans say. And apparently the American president is like a person watching from the audience. He's in the bleachers. I don't know. I believe it when I see it. That's not something he's supposed to be able to say. But you see an absent landlord, so to speak. Definitely not a leader exerting power. It's certainly not one who understands the dynamics. And then you have these on the European side and the Ukraine side who just don't care what the reality is. They are going to go for it and just hold to a verbal hope of what they want, oblivious and ignoring the reality. Whereas on the Russian side, they still say we prefer a diplomatic outcome, but we are in prepared, we are trained, we are equipped, and we are supplied with everything we need to extract it on the battlefield with no negotiations, with no submissions. We're not going to concede anything because we don't have to. We'll only have a negotiated settlement where we don't take everything we want if you're willing to, because then that's the only way that there is any benefit for Russia to negotiate is if they can get their main tasks without shedding any more blood to get it. But they're not going to sacrifice their core issues, which is the root causes of the war, which is what Putin said there in June 2024. If they don't get those, then they're simply going to take them. They would be foolish, and they recognize this, and the Russian people recognize this. They would literally be foolish to give into any version of what the Europeans and the Ukrainians are saying today when they have the power to compel compliance on their terms. It would be foolish. I don't think it's ever happened in the history of humanity, and I've studied warfare a lot. And I mean, looking back centuries, I've never seen anything to where the side that had the power to compel compliance chose not to. And it's not going to happen here either, folks. So what you're seeing from this Zelensky statement, and by the way, I've seen lots of people going back to his comment there about how brave he was about giving that statement. That's only people can only say that when they don't understand what's going on, when they're not aware of the combat realities. And for civilians, I can understand that, because we're so focused on images and visuals and especially well-made videos. And Zelensky is brilliant at that, always has been. And when that's all they see, they think, wow, that sounds really motivated, really, really inspiring. What a great leader. It's only a great leader if you have no idea what's going on. And if you keep going on with that great video and great images, all you're going to do is add to the body count for the Ukraine side, and you will just add to the ultimate cost of the failure. The failure is already known. They have lost the war. It's over already. The end is determined. We know the end is coming, and the Ukraine side lost. The only outstanding information that we don't have is what will the final toll be? What will the final tally be? How many bodies will be lost? How much territory will be lost? How many cities will be destroyed, et cetera? That's the only part we don't know yet. And, of course, the other wild card is, will this war expand beyond the borders of Ukraine? Will we get sucked into the war, whether we being NATO or Europe or the United States? That's the only part that's still unknown. And I pray to God that even delusionary leaders like we have are not suicidal as well, that would start a war that could all too easily go nuclear and expand it to direct conflict with Russia. Hopefully they'll just, I don't know, try to spin the loss. At this point, that's the least bad option of a loss. Spin the loss, but don't get us into a conflict as well. So we'll have to wait and see how that's going to happen. But you need to understand that's the reality, folks, today. Whatever you're hearing is going to come out from the rest of this meeting at Geneva, whatever Rubio may say next, because obviously everything he said yesterday has almost been sabotaged already by our so-called allies in Europe and Ukraine. We'll see how it's going to work out. And I guess like President Trump, I'll believe it when I see it if something good happens. But we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth, and you need to know it on all sides here, and we're going to continue to do that because you deserve it, and we will continue to give it to you. Thanks very much, folks. We're going to have Andre Mardianov, who's going to look at some additional issues that we have today that we haven't discussed here on this. He's going to give us some more depth, and especially on what the Russians are thinking. A lot of this, we focused today mostly on the United States and the European and Ukraine side. He's going to give us this deeper intellectual understanding on the Russian side later this afternoon, 2 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. We'll see you then.